This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, summertime is upon us, and that means lots of time in the pool and splashing around at the beach. But roughly 1,000 kids die each year in the U.S. from drowning. We're joined by a local Safe Kids coordinator to get drowning prevention tips, especially when it comes to swimming in open waters, which is where most drowning deaths actually occur. But first, Florida's August 28th primary election is now less than 3 months away, and things are heating up on the campaign trail for candidates in the Republican and Democratic races for the governor's office. Democratic candidates, including former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham, former Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, Orlando businessman Chris King, and former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, faced off in their third debate Monday evening. Billionaire and Palm Beach County real estate tycoon Jeff Green officially filed paperwork earlier this month to run for the governor as a Democrat as well. Despite Green's late entry and his absence from the debate stage so far, his substantial wealth has the potential to shake up the primary. Green spent $30 million of his own money back in 2010 in a failed U.S. Senate bid. And just quick correction, I believe I said Andrew Gillum was the former Tallahassee mayor, and that's not true. He is the current Tallahassee mayor. On the Republican side, gubernatorial candidate and current Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services Secretary Adam Putnam has been on the defensive in recent days, following a report from the Tampa Bay Times that his department failed to check the National Instant Criminal Background Check System on concealed carry weapons permit applications in the state for more than a year between February of 2016 and March of last year. Putnam's primary contender in the GOP gubernatorial primary, U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis, has been quick to criticize his opponent over the background check lapse. Joining me now for a closer look at the race for the governor's mansion and what the results of the primary could set up for the general election in November are Florida Gulf Coast University political science professors Dr. Peter Bergerson and Dr. Roger Green. Gentlemen, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for taking the time.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
As always, I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And let's begin with a look at the Democratic gubernatorial primary race. Monday evening, we saw the third public debate with those top four candidates I mentioned. And they've agreed to two more on July 18th and August 2nd before the actual primary election. Just kind of wanted to get your general impressions of the candidates' debate performances. Did it seem particularly civil to you?
Well, it got a little bit heated at times. I mean, I think part of the reason why it got a little bit volatile at certain points is Phil Levine has kind of thrown things into a little more uncertainty for some of the more established political candidate, you know, politicians like Gwen Graham and Andrew Gillum, and so they're finding, you know, they have to find some way to you know, find a few chinks in his armor because of the formidable financial resources that he has. But I don't know that the debate did much, at least for me, in terms of providing a clear picture of how the candidates are likely to fare vis-a-vis one another moving forward.
Yeah.
I got the impression that the Democratic candidates were trying to determine who was the most progressive or perhaps, excuse me, who was the most liberal. And I just to build on what Roger said, Levine's entering the race. He's already spent approximately $10 million on statewide funding, and that may that may have raised some contentious issues, at least under the surface, because he's then cut into, as Roger suggested, the more established candidates in Andrew Gillum and Gwen Graham.
I used the term civil before just because, you know, whether it's dealing with a lack of affordable housing or banning assault weapons, increasing the minimum wage, increasing teacher pay, combating climate change, you know, these candidates by and large seem to agree with one another. The differences between them, as far as what I can tell, don't seem to be so much about platform or policy.
No, I don't think there are many differences at this point. But that doesn't surprise me in a primary campaign, because primary elections tend to overweight sort of the true believers. They're more likely to show up and vote in primary season. So So this would be a more progressive set of constituents that they would be – that they would be competing for. And for those constituents, these, you know, assault weapons ban, raising the minimum wage, teachers' pay improvements, all of those things are pretty much those are actually safe positions to take. Things become, of course, more complicated in the general election, but in the primary season, certainly that's going to be the way all of them are going to go. I think at this point,
I guess I would, in addition to Roger's observation. Keep in mind it's still early, and the civility may not last. And also the debate forum is really not a place to be caustic, because that then will become the news story as opposed to the debate or the issues. The attack would then be the headline, and I think that's what they all wanted to avoid.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, the attacks are more likely to come – you know, through as we, you know, kind of move farther along through independently financed or outside financed TV advertisements that will have some distance personally from the candidates. But yeah, I think Peter's right in the debates. I don't think we're going to see on the Democratic side anything too caustic. Maybe a little bit different on the Republican side. But.
Yeah. And, you know, perhaps more often than taking shots at each other, I've noticed the candidates criticizing President Trump and Governor Scott on the debate stage. Do you expect that to maybe ramp up or tone down once the primary is over?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely ramp up.
Okay.
Almost every polling among Democrats, particularly the traditional Democratic voter, you see 90% anti-Trump. And I'm not so sure that Governor Scott is far behind that feeling among Democratic voters of a dislike.
And positioning for the general election, more centrist or moderate Republicans, sort of an anti-Trump message would more likely resonate with them as well. So that's a pretty strategic and safe position for the Democratic candidates to be taking.
And until billionaire Jeff Green entered the race just shy of 2 weeks ago, Chris King kind of stood out among the front runners in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. He's really the only one who didn't come from a political background. The first sentence in the Meet Chris portion of his campaign website reads, "Chris isn't a professional politician." So, you know, he's really selling himself as this progressive businessman and entrepreneur. I'm wondering if you think that's an effective selling point. I mean, is that something Democrats really care about, or is touting one's lack of political experience as a positive typically a selling point for Republican voters?
Well, I think thus far what I've seen, it doesn't seem to be resonating. Maybe if it were a different field of candidates vying for the Democratic nomination, it would be different. But right now my feeling is that Chris King is having some difficulty getting traction through that message. How much of that is due to the message and how much of it is due to his style, I'm not sure. But it does not seem to be resonating thus far the way that I think he would have hoped.
I would add as well is that oftentimes, particularly in the primary elections, it's a name recognition and name recall within the base voters, particularly in the Democratic Party. And if they really haven't had a campaign legacy, so to say, or held office, they're, you know, and again, lacking that name ID, you know, and unless he really is going to spend some of this billion that he has, at least reported to be by Forbes magazine, a legitimate billionaire, that might make a difference. But he also seems to have a slow startup, you know, in other words, that he's announced it, but all of a sudden then he's gone flat.
And at Saturday's debate, Chris King, you know, said Trump's election victory offers an important lesson for Democrats, and that is that the economy is key. Let's hear from some audio from that debate.
He tapped in to the anxiety across this state for so many people who have not seen the Democratic Party talk about pocketbook issues. The Democrats, to win, have to have an economic vision.
I mean, is going after the economy really going to be an effective selling point? I mean, the employment rate's really healthy kind of across the board. I mean, is that really a big talking point or a hot button issue this year?
I don't know that it's going to be the issue that kind of rhetoric would suggest. And in addition, I would even say that it's much murkier, more questionable how much of a role that played in Trump's electoral success in the presidential election. And clearly, you heard a lot said that pointed toward economic anxieties, but those were interwoven with a lot of cultural acrimony and anxieties and kind of status anxieties. So I wouldn't agree that a simple kind of populist or progressive economic platform is going to be a successful strategy in the gubernatorial election in Florida this year.
I would add that I think that a significant portion of Trump's vote was not so much based on economics as was based on the feeling of being neglected or alienated and not being addressed. And particularly, at least in past years, what might have been referred to as the Reagan Democrats. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that in perhaps in Florida, but surely in the Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, they're the ones that made the difference, I think. And so, again, it wasn't so much jobs. It's that they're stagnant and the policies that they're alienated from.
And, you know, King has also said, and maybe this is one of the ways he's kind of distinguishing himself from his Democratic rivals, he wants to generate a greater tax revenue for the state by legalizing recreational marijuana. Given that the legal issues going on now with the implementation of Florida's legalization of medical marijuana and how Florida's legislative system works, I mean, is legalizing recreational marijuana really something a governor can do, regardless of who it is?
No.
No. I think that would be something you'd have to see happen through, a ballot initiative. But it is interesting, though, for him to say that as a way of distinguishing himself from other candidates who are taking the more cautious stance of saying, oh, I'm strongly supportive of, the decriminalization of marijuana and medical marijuana, but I want to more carefully and patiently study the issue of recreation. I mean, that's sort of the Gwen Graham approach, and I think that would be, that would probably be the most astute approach to for a Democratic candidate to take in this election.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Gwen Graham, how have you seen things change for her in this race? I mean, because she's perhaps one of the most notable Democrats in this race. Her father is, of course, former governor and former U.S. Senator Bob Graham, who trivia, actually hosted this show one time during one of his workday events. But is she really, sort of using her political, background and her, personal affiliations there to her advantage?
Well, I think first of all that it's interesting to look back a few months ago. And I remember most of the people I knew who are knowledgeable political observers were saying, Gwen Graham, is sort of the clear front runner. I mean, she comes from a family that's well known in Florida politics. She has name familiarity. She's well connected, a reasonable amount of wealth behind her. And I think she's struggling a little bit right now to figure out the appropriate strategy for dealing with the entry of candidates in the primary who have immense personal wealth. And I think I've yet to see her, kind of signal the strategy she's going to take to kind of crack through the advantage that they might enjoy through their personal wealth. The other thing, and Peter can talk a little bit more about this, but, her strength in terms of geography is in a portion of Florida now that is, not really the most strategically valuable region of Florida in the primary season, at least. But Peter
right.
can
no,
talk
but,
about that.
No, just absolutely. You're right, Roger, that being from the Panhandle area, that's where, she served in the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives from. you know, she's stalled is, I think, the, perhaps the best way of saying it. She perhaps has the most definitive positions on almost every major issue that, at least that I have seen, across the board. And she has a record of being somewhat bipartisan, but I think one of the things that now that there are five candidates on a Democratic side, it's sucking the oxygen out of the air, particularly, again, going back to the amount of money that Levine is spending and the attention that he's getting from it, and that he is a South Florida where the heavy Democratic vote is. I'm not so sure the polls are completely accurate, but they, you know, what we do are available. Why, you know, he seems to be the, you know, he seems to be the front runner.
And just a little sidebar here. When I was listening to the debate on Saturday, something Gwen Graham said really caught my attention whenever they were discussing the issue of school safety. And she talked about using a little-known state law if elected. Let's hear what she said.
I have found a public safety statute that allows the governor, whoever she may be, to sign an executive order for public safety reasons banning the sale of military-style assault weapons.
Do either of you have any insight on that proposal? I mean, the governor just unilaterally banning assault-style weapons. I mean, would that work, or is this just setting the stage for an expensive legal battle that the taxpayers would be on the hook for?
I would anticipate an expensive legal battle, but it's – I mean, it's a position that is interesting for her to announce. I mean, one thing I do want to say, because a number of candidates on the Democratic side have talked about an assault weapons ban. If you talk with serious policy analysts about the efficacy of a ban on the sale of AR-15 style or assault weapon style rifles, most of them are going to say that's really not going to do that much, partly in large part because there is such an immense number of assault weapons out there in sort of the resale market that a ban on the sale of new assault weapons, which is what they're basically talking about, it's unclear that that would have much of an impact. That's more of a resonant symbolic position to take, talking about banning the sale of assault weapons by licensed dealers, but that's not really going to do a lot in terms of significantly modifying the levels of gun violence.
So more or less a talking point, and
I'm the most
progressive of the progressives battle.
It's a talking point, and it's also one that is less likely to antagonize even, you know, centrist Republicans, moderate Republicans and the like. I mean, if you were talking about more extensive regulatory restrictions on guns or then it would be a little bit riskier in the general election. But assault weapons sale ban on assault weapon sales now is sort of a safe symbolic position for Democratic candidates to take.
Gotcha. Yeah,
I would agree, and it would be immediately challenged in the courts,
right.
Not only in Florida, but it would be immediately challenged in the U.S. Courts as well.
Well, less than 3 months before Florida's primary election, we're taking a closer look at the Republican and Democratic gubernatorial primary races with FGCU political science experts Roger Green and Peter Bergerson. Call in and join the conversation with your comments and questions. Which candidate or candidates for governor have a message that resonates with you? And why? Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And, you know, all of the Democratic candidates have, you know, been part of these – that have been part of these debates anyway are coming out strongly in favor of stricter firearm regulations, banning these assault-style weapons as we've just been discussing. Do you get the impression perhaps that Andrew Gillum is kind of coming out strongest on this issue? And by that I just mean on Saturday he took it beyond, you know, stricter firearm regulation and, you know, invoked the names of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman talking about stand your ground laws.
And because of stand your ground laws, which have no place in civilized society, he was able to engage him, snuff out his life, and get away with it.
I mean, is repealing Stand Your Ground, you know, an important talking point, at least for left-leaning voters? Is that something you've been hearing?
Well, I don't think so. Look, it is an important issue. There's no question about Stand Your Ground, but I think that was yesterday, and I don't see that as a – I see gun control and regulation as an issue, but not Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting point for him to make if he's trying to differentiate himself from a slate of candidates where all of them are calling for stricter controls over guns. But I'm skeptical at this point as to whether that would have much traction.
I would guess that excuse me, the Parkland School District shooting and the nightclub as well would have better traction politically.
What about the issue of climate change and sea level rise? It seems like this is an area where Philip Levine would, have the advantage being, the former mayor of a city that's, already experiencing impacts from that. Let's hear what Philip Levine had to say on Saturday.
I raised roads, put in pumps, raised seawalls, put together a $500 million infrastructure program.
You know, always an important issue for your left-leaning voters. Is this somewhere, do you think, where Levine might have the advantage?
I would say Levine has the advantage on this. I mean, partly because of where he served as mayor. I mean, Miami has the Miami metropolitan region. I mean, for people who don't live there, I think a lot of people don't realize how severe the problems already are with sea level rise in many areas of Miami. So this is something that's going to resonate with voters on the East Coast of Florida. And Levine can kind of position himself and claim some credit for having taken action on this in the past. Others, I don't think any of the other candidates on the Democratic side would disagree with adopting measures that would be geared toward mitigating the problems associated with climate change and sea level rise. It's just that they can't claim something in their prior work or record that positions them well. So I think Levine has an advantage on that one.
I think he does in the primary election because he's from Miami Beach.
Yeah.
I think the environmental issues will take center place in the general election, of which the climate change and the rising sea level in southeast Florida will have an impact. But I think perhaps more significantly, and even for our area, tends to be Lake Okeechobee and the flow and other and the Everglades. I think those are statewide issues that present traction.
Right. And then, sort of the wild card issue here is, billionaire and real estate tycoon Jeff Green, with this late entry into the race just at the beginning of this month. Did that catch you off guard? Were you expecting that?
No, I wasn't expecting that, and it did catch me off guard. Although, as I think we were talking about before the show started, I've reached the point now almost of being somewhat despondent about the rising level of importance or advantage for personal wealth in American politics. So maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. However, it's interesting now in a Democratic primary race that already featured some immense personal wealth, in the persons of Phil Levine and Chris King. It's interesting to see now a billionaire entering the race. I'm going to be curious to see how he does. He's entering very late. He doesn't seem to have done much to lay the groundwork for quickly gaining the momentum in the primary season. Now, one thing that's quite interesting, and we'll have to see how this plays out the next few weeks. This happened just this morning. Green said, basically conveyed the impression that if he gets the Democratic nomination in the gubernatorial race, he will have a lot of money to share with Democratic candidates in legislative and congressional races so that he will share a large portion of his war chest, kind of distributed among his allies. That's a very interesting strategy to see if he can get some additional assistance through that to make up for his late entry into the race.
Well, that'll help him get endorsements maybe, but not necessarily votes.
It's not necessarily votes, and it's not going to be any kind of substitute for establishing or building rapidly the name familiarity, which he's going to have to do through things like television ads. But he has the money to mount a rapid offensive when it comes to television advertising.
I think he sees the Rick Scott model as his path to the governor's mansion. You know, when 8 years ago, Rick Scott spends $70 million out of his own pocket, astronomical even today, by today's standards, more or less 8 years ago.
And just narrowly won the election, but far outspent his opponents.
Yeah, right. Right.
But if I had to make a prediction, I'll make a kind of – I don't know if this is a bold prediction. But if Jeff Green were the only immensely wealthy candidate, you know, in among the Democrats vying for the nomination in the gubernatorial race, I might have a little more confidence that he could gain the necessary traction. But I think in a race that already features people like Phil Levine – who have immense personal wealth and some, you know, much more in the way of political background in the state of Florida. I would predict that Green will not enjoy the Rick Scott, you know, level of success. And there are some things in his background. I mean, a huge portion of his personal wealth was gained by, you know, essentially taking advantage of the catastrophic, you know, downturn in the national real estate market, essentially betting against these, you know, collateralized debt instruments and the like. There's a lot that opponents could use against the way he acquired his wealth.
Yeah, I remember that conversation I had with him back in 2010, really touting how, you know, saying that he saw the bursting of the housing bubble coming and made his money that way. And I'm like, And I'm just like, well, okay, but you want the job of in public service. Like, how is this? I don't know.
That would be a better talking point if he were vying for the Republican nomination, but not when he's trying to appeal to progressives in a Democratic primary.
Right. It's like you made a lot of money, but a lot of other people had to lose their houses in order for that to happen.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, one of the things that I think is going to be interesting is that it probably is going to – the person who's able to get 25% of the vote is going to be the nominee in the Democratic Party with at least three, if not four, well-known or, you know, actively campaigning. It's really going to divide the vote. And so that will be – and I think that's what Levine's strategy was, is to be early and often – with the campaign commercials,
and of course remember too that we could see one, at least one, possibly two of the Democratic candidates in the coming 4 to 6 weeks dropping out of the race, and then the issue would be: are they going to endorse another one of the candidates? You know, I think as we move closer to the primary election, you're going to see this huge body of undecided voters starting to, you know, kind of display their preferences, at which point, you know, I think that Gwen Graham and Phil Levine are going to be – they're going to have some legs. I think Jeff Green just because of his money. But, you know, Andrew Gillum will – we'll have to see. I don't know if he's going to get the traction and whether he's going to stay in the race, you know, beyond another 4 to 6 weeks.
So this could be like his 2010 Senate bid all over again.
Yeah.
Spend tens of millions of dollars, but then maybe
we don't know. And that could shake things up, because right now on both the Democratic and Republican sides, a huge portion of the voters are completely undecided.
Yeah.
Well, another thing I think will probably happen on the Democratic side is that campaign contributions are going to start to dry up. and it's going to they're going to be looking at internal polling that's being done, and I think some of the candidates who don't show up well in the horse race side of it, they're going to be without money to run the whole race.
Well, let's turn to the Republican ticket here, where I think the clear front runners are Congressman Ron DeSantis and current State Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam. And perhaps the biggest issue in recent days as it pertains to that race is the recent revelations that the Department of Ag failed to run concealed carry permit holder applications through the National Instant Criminal Background Check System for more than a year. That has ultimately resulted in 291 concealed weapon permits that were issued ultimately being revoked. The story was broke by the Tampa Bay Times just days ago, but the information comes from a year-old Inspector General report. Could this have come at a worse time for Adam Putnam?
No. Actually, the only way it could have come at a worse time would have been if he had won the Republican nomination and this came out during the general election campaign. Then it would be truly devastating. I think it has really taken away a lot of the momentum that he had been building, though. It's not as devastating as it would be for, you know, a Democratic candidate, obviously. But it's allowed DeSantis, who has been getting, you know, he's got some more money flowing his way in terms of campaign contributions, and he has some national presence and the like through his, you know, periodic exposure on the Fox cable network. But I think it's allowed DeSantis to get some momentum. It's just been wonderful for him. And it's obviously had an impact. Now, I'm not sure if it's going to have a lasting impact, but the fact that it allowed DeSantis to quickly make up some ground, I mean, it's basically, you know, kind of a dead heat right now with a lot of undecided voters. It's had a real impact.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that even the governor has offered his own take on it. Is that, quote unquote, he found it disturbing, is how he, I think, characterized it. And so this is an issue, again, because of the Parkland school shooting. It is still really a raw issue here in politics. And so the length of this as an issue, I think, will depend on how DeSantis uses it and how much he drills away at it. That I think, will be one of the things. And at the same time, though, they have to be very careful not to avoid the NRA, because both of them are really trying to out conservative, or who's the most defender of the NRA or what they guns.
Yeah, a lot of the hardcore Republican voters, for them, this is probably not that big of an issue. I mean, the issue would not be so much the lax approach to concealed carry permit review. It would be more a question of competence in your political position. But if Putnam were to get the Republican nomination, I think we will really see the Democratic opponent bring that issue up pretty relentlessly, because then it's a huge issue in the general election.
Yeah, no question about it.
Are you basically saying, I guess, are there big differences that you see in the platforms between Putnam and DeSantis, or is it kind of like what we're seeing in the Democratic primary, just on the other end, like the Democrats are I'm the most progressive, and the Republicans are I'm the most conservative?
Well, in terms of the campaign rhetoric, I don't think there's very much difference at all. I mean, I think if you kind of set aside the campaign rhetoric and you try to make some predictions about the likely policy orientation of Putnam versus DeSantis, if either of them were to win the governor's office, I think Putnam would be a decidedly less extreme conservative than DeSantis would be. But in terms of the current campaign rhetoric you're hearing from the two, I mean, DeSantis really is a scorched earth, hardcore Tea Party style conservative. Putnam is doing everything he can to portray himself as a scorched earth, hardcore conservative. So I don't think there's much difference in the positions or the rhetoric at this point. But I think one would carry that rhetoric forward into actual practice if he were to become the governor, and that's Ron DeSantis.
I think when we talked previously about the civility in the Democratic side, I think what we're going to see is just the opposite on the Republican side. Mm. In other words, it's going to be a question of personalities. It's not going to be an issue of policy differences because the differences are so minuscule in differences. So it's going to be a question of, I think, of temperament and who is the most loyal to President Trump. In other words,
DeSantis has the Trump's endorsement.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah.
certainly going to help him in the primary, but could that backfire in the general?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Whoever the Democratic nominee is, that is going to be one of the big issues. And I think also in the general, but I don't want to go that way too much, but we have a Senate race coming up.
Yes.
And so the incumbent governor and Trump are going to be part of the Democratic Party's talking points as a way of getting their base and their supporters to the polls.
Final question on that issue here. We've talked in the past many times, and you've told me Democrats just tend to not come out to the polls, particularly during non-presidential election years.
Yeah.
Could that be different this year with the Trump presidency?
Well, between the Trump presidency and the fact that I think the tragedies like the one at Parkland will, I think, still have some traction to them, I think we could see a little more Democratic turnout. I've become a little bit skeptical over the past couple of decades about making any kind of confident predictions about Democratic turnout in non-presidential election years, though, because I've seen too many instances where people were saying, "No, I think this time around it's going to be different," and then it isn't. I think the turnout problem will still exist for Democrats. However, the question is how severe the turnout problem will be. If it's only a moderate turnout problem as compared to prior non-presidential election years, that would be a tremendous boost for the Democratic candidate.
Yeah, I would agree that over elections in off year or non-presidential years, there's a pretty well established pattern of voter turnout and who turns out and who doesn't. And so partially it's going to depend on at least on the Democratic side who wins the nomination as it appeals to where the Democratic voters are. That will be a key, I think, in the turnout factor.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, but thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Florida Gulf Coast University political science professors Peter Bergerson and Roger Green. Always a pleasure.
Nice to be here, John.
Yeah, thanks, John.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, Julie Glenn returns to the host chair to explore summertime safety tips for parents whose kids are going to be splashing around in the pools and at the beach. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.